Hi, this is Kale. I want to remind you that this episode has spoilers for Why the Last Man by Brian K. Vaughan, with art by Pia Guerrero. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Matt and Kale Read Comics. Every episode, Kale and I discuss a different graphic novel. My name is Matt Smith. I am a Canadian and British cartoonist and comics educator living in Paisley, Scotland.
Hi, and I'm Kale Wierke. I'm a longtime mainstream comic book fan, YouTuber, cosplayer, podcaster, collector, and former filmmaker.
I'm impressed you're still saying that all in one breath, Kale, as your list of credits continues. Very excited to talk about Why the Last Man. This is one of my favorite ongoing series. It's over now. That it lasted for 60 issues. It's fantastic. We've kind of grappled with how to talk about longer series. We really have been trying to stick to kind of self-contained graphic novels, one and done, that you don't need to invest too much time. But the kind of our workaround is we're going to just look at the first volume, the first collected trade paperback, which looks at the first five issues of this series. Why the Last Man, written by Brian K. Vaughan, who has a background in writing for TV. He was actually one of the writers on Lost. It's penciled by Pia Guerrero, and she's also credited as co-creator, so the two of them created the series together. And then it has inks by Jose Marzan Jr. And as the series continues, there are different guest artists that come in and help Pia Guerrero with the art load, because doing an ongoing series is quite arduous a task, and it's quite a responsibility when you are the main artist, and sometimes you have to bring in guest artists to kind of help catch up. But for these five issues, it's this core creative team. Before we talk about that though, Kale, I want to talk about just the fact that I've actually been watching movies again. As listeners know, I have a newborn son at home. He just turned 14 weeks. When this episode comes out, he'll be turning 15 weeks. It's been hard to watch movies, but my wife Emma and I went to the outdoor cinema at Pollock Park here in Glasgow, and we watched the original Jurassic Park outside. Have you seen Jurassic Park recently, Kale?
It's been a while, quite honestly, but I love Jurassic Park. I think it's one of the perfect kind of summer thriller movies pretty much up there with things like Die Hard. It's just pure perfection. You can't really go wrong with Jurassic Park, the original. I'm not so much for the sequels, but the original is just perfect.
It is a shame just the disparity in quality between the original and the sequels. There's some good parts in some of them. I liked the first half of Jurassic World when they just went to the park, and it was just basically like a video brochure for this park, Jurassic World, and I just want to go there. And then inevitably everything goes wrong and the dinosaurs escape and everything, but I was just really enjoying that first part. But the word you keep using, perfection, about Jurassic Park, oh my gosh, Kale, like, I was just blown away at just how everything just works in that film, and everything is set up and it pays off later, and it's just like a well-oiled machine. Everything fits together. There's no wasted element. Everything is working towards propelling the story and developing the characters, and every throwaway line, every joke, every shot, it's just everything matters. And it does connect to this graphic novel, because I have read this whole thing through. I think I'm going to continue reading it now, because I just really enjoyed reading these first five issues. But it just reminds me Brian K. Vaughan's writing to the plotting of Jurassic Park, where everything is set up, everything matters, every little throwaway line all builds towards the themes, and nothing is wasted. And it was just amazing watching Jurassic Park in a cinema setting. It was also really good because I don't think I've ever seen it the whole way through, because when I was a kid and when it came out, I was young, living in Bangkok, Thailand, where my parents took us to see it. And anytime there was a scary part in the movie, they made me and my brother Andrew put our heads down between our legs, between our knees, and cover our ears for any scary parts. So that opening scene where, like, the raptor's breaking out and kills one of the park wardens, I never saw that until I was much older, and I was like, holy crap, this movie is terrifying in parts. So there's parts that I had never really seen in context until now, you know, this week I've seen the whole thing through. But you know what really kind of bugs me is I've shared this story with my brother, and he revealed that he actually looked and peeked. So he didn't keep his eyes closed. He actually was watching the scary parts of these movies.
Oh man, that's the best part, because the way I saw it was I was taken there as a new immigrant to the United States by our foster family. And I was seated right in front. And so I saw the dinosaurs, you know, like right, you know, in front of me. And it was so like
life
impressive.
Size almost.
Life size, yeah. And they didn't shield me for anything. So, I mean, I think I remember laughing about the lawyer, you know, when he's sitting on the toilet and he gets
eaten on the toilet. Yeah.
So good. So good.
When you gotta go, you gotta go. It's, there's just so many classic lines too that you forget, like just how much that movie is so quotable. And the shot of Jeff Goldblum with his chest exposed, you know, glistening chest. It was very appreciated by the crowd. Everyone kind of gave it a knowing chuckle and a little bit of an applause when that came on the big screen. Yeah, very enjoyable. If you're listening and you haven't seen Jurassic Park in a while, go see it. Awesome. Can I ask just really quick? I don't think I've ever asked you this. Do they censor movies in Sri Lanka?
To a certain extent, yes, they do. I remember seeing Who Framed Roger Rabbit in Sri Lanka, and they censored some stuff, but I didn't notice, I guess, when I was a kid. Obviously, you know, Jessica Rabbit was still pretty sexy. I remember that. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they cut everything out.
Jessica Rabbit, one of my first childhood crushes, seeing a cartoon like that, definitely had an effect on me when I was younger. But Bangkok didn't edit things out, but in Malaysia, which I moved to Malaysia after we left Bangkok, they definitely censored things, so violence and swearing. But it was always kind of funny when they did a bad job of editing the swearing, because there was a lot of times where whoever was cutting just couldn't keep up. When I saw the movie Role Models, the little kid who swears, they couldn't, it was just too much for the editor, and he ended up just leaving, I assume it was a he, I don't know, whoever the editor was ended up just leaving in the swearing and cutting out pretty much the rest of the kid's speech. So it was just the bad words left in.
That's so funny.
I know. It's a tough job. Speaking of movies as well, Kale, yesterday I saw The Suicide Squad, and it was amazing. Have you seen it yet?
I have not. I'm just kind of waiting till it comes out on video on demand. I guess it is out right now, actually.
Yeah, it's simultaneous release with the cinema, so you can see it. You got to pay, obviously, more than you would pay to go see in the cinema. I'm not comfortable yet going back to the cinema, but I watched it with a friend last night, and it was amazing. If you're a fan of our show, I really think that you'd enjoy it. It's just such an unabashedly comic book movie. It's got, like, larger than life crazy characters. It's so funny. It's so well written. The first like 10 minutes of The Suicide Squad is so much better than Suicide Squad that came out a few years ago. I did not enjoy the original Suicide Squad movie. Emma took me to see it and she booed the screen when the credits came up and asked me why I wanted to see it. And I reminded her it was actually her idea to go see it. I did not choose to see it, but The Suicide Squad, I highly, highly, highly recommend it. I won't say too much more because I don't want to spoil it for you or anyone listening. But if you haven't seen The Suicide Squad, seek it out. It's a fantastic movie and a fantastic comic book movie.
Yeah. No, I'm really looking forward to seeing it. Originally, I was kind of turned off by it because of the original movie. And I was like, why are they even making a sequel to this movie? Because it was pretty terrible. But it is James Gunn. And James Gunn is an awesome director with a questionable past. But I enjoyed his Guardians movies, and so I expected Suicide Squad to also be of that quality.
It's awesome. I haven't seen the Guardians of the Galaxy movies for a while. I think I probably enjoyed The Suicide Squad better than Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Not that I didn't enjoy Volume 2. I don't remember if it's better than Guardians of the Galaxy, the original. But it's definitely up there, written, directed by James Gunn, The Suicide Squad. Oh, I want to watch it again. Amazing. Anyways, Why the Last Man? A really great book. I'm a huge fan. You actually suggested this, Kale, when you and I were talking in between episodes about what we're going to do next. Why did you want to read this book?
Well, recently there was a trailer released for the television show Why the Last Man, and then it reminded me of Why the Last Man, the comic, which I had read several years ago. So I just love this series. I thought the story is so well done, and it, you know, especially for the first five volumes, I suppose, that we kind of read for this episode. The
first five issues. Sorry, in volume one. Yeah,
that's correct. Yes. They kind of allude to several options as to why all the men died. And you're just trying to figure out what happened. And there's this like ongoing mystery, which I kind of liked. But also, it's a great concept. You know, what if all the men died and then it was up to women to kind of rebuild society? And not everyone would be in line with what society is like right now. And, you know, things would break down. So I found it very fascinating overall as a storyline.
Yeah, it's such a great book. It's such a cool concept. It takes this very kind of well-worn trope of like, what if you were the last man on Earth? But what I love about Brian K. Vaughan's writing is he takes these ideas. Like, he starts with this fairly, you know, well-worn idea, like I said, this kind of nugget. But he really just pulls apart and just really, really, really digs into all the ramifications. What if... So the concept is something, a plague that is unexplained, causes every creature on Earth with a Y chromosome to die, except for our main character, York Brown, and his pet monkey. He's got a helper capuchin monkey named Ampersand. So every other creature with a Y chromosome is dead except for these two characters. And he really, really examines, okay, so what does that mean? What are the ramifications? What happens to the U.S. government? His mother is a representative, and she is dealing with the wives, the widows of other representatives who want to take their husband's seats in the government. And she tries to explain that, you know, that's not how the U.S. government works. But in the U.S. government, if there are women in positions like his mother is a representative, there are more women that are on the liberal side of the U.S. government. And the more conservative side is mostly men. So if all the men died, then the U.S. government would be tipped towards the liberal side. And that causes a shift in power. And then these widows of the conservative representatives, they feel that they're not being represented because now their husbands aren't there to be in the government. So he pulls apart and just really, really, really thinks about like what actually would happen. And he thinks about, you know, who would be the strongest military? And the answer in this book is the Israeli military, because they've got women serving in active combat where other governments don't have women in on the front line so much, at least at the time of this book. And later on, as the series goes on, we don't want to give too much away, but the strongest navy is the Australian Navy, because they have the most women serving in the Navy. And I just love that he really, really, really thinks about like what would this world be like, and really, really pulls it apart. And, you know, the realistic ramifications, the micro and the macro. And it's just fascinating to really spend time seeing what and really thinking about all these questions that you wouldn't think about when you just think about being the last man on Earth.
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept. And this book was written during the Bush era. So George W. Bush, I would say, not Bush Sr., but I
Bush think 2 that, Electric Boogaloo.
Exactly. So I think that it is definitely a work of fiction of the time. But it is kind of interesting that, you know, things would... your society would evolve in a certain way. And yeah, I was thinking of the highways full of just a bunch of cars. It kind of reminded me of The Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. And how like their highways are also full of just cars, because all the men who are driving died, and just you can't kind of use the highway system at all unless you have motorcycles or something. So, yeah, it's really interesting, you know, and the fact that I was expecting in the book when York ends up being the only man that he would be hunted by women to procreate, but at least in the first few first five issues that doesn't quite happen. But yeah, it's a lot on his shoulders for sure as a character too, to kind of repopulate, quote unquote, repopulate the planet.
Yeah, they address that head on in this first volume, where, again, I don't know, like, I'll ask you this question in a second, but, like, I'm sure a lot of people have thought about what it would be like to be either the last of their gender or the last person in general, like, flat out the last human alive. And obviously the question of repopulation comes up very early, and he very quickly says no. He, in his mind, he's engaged. So right at the moment that the plague hits and this apocalypse happens and all the men start dying, he's on the phone to his girlfriend Beth, who's in Australia, and he proposes, and the power goes out and the phone lines die before he gets an answer. So in his mind, he is engaged and he acts and calls her his fiance, but we don't actually see what her answer is, and we won't see Beth for many, many issues. But he straight up acknowledges, you know, no, I'm not gonna, he says I'm not interested in being a stud, and he doesn't want to just, you know, start reproducing and procreating with as many women as possible. So they do kind of address, you know, that is kind of one of the hokey sort of answers, like, what would you do if you were the last man on Earth? Well, man, you know, it'd be up to me to repopulate. And they do address this, and I think that's one of the things that makes him endearing as a character. He's very, you know, he doesn't do a lot of the typical things that you expect. I really dig York as a character. I'm going to talk about him in a second. I just want to say, like, this book did come out in 2002. It's also very much a post 9/11 book, very much influenced by the fears in America and the Western world in general after the attacks on September 11th. So it does kind of live in this kind of post-terrorism world, and people are talking about, you mentioned briefly, there's all these kind of theories put out there of what did cause the plague and who's to blame, something that's not really answered. But really quick, I do want to ask you, like, have you thought much about being the last man on Earth? Have you ever had this kind of, you know, let your mind run in that direction?
I haven't quite thought about it, honestly. I haven't thought about it because I don't think it's quite possible. So it's not in the realm of possibility in my mind.
I mean, there's been times where I just am a little bit fed up and just wonder what it'd be like to maybe not have everyone else die, but just kind of go away and be on my own. And also, you know, have you ever, there's something kind of cool about having the world to yourself, and not in such a grand dystopian idea, but, like, I, you know, just being the only one awake in a house, or getting up early and being the only one on the street and the rest of the world is sleeping, and it's just the world is yours and you're not sharing with anyone. I like those little stolen moments, and I like that idea sometimes. I obviously wouldn't want to live my entire life like that, but there is something appealing of just being left to your own devices and this is yours. Like, I think I like the idea of, like, having a hotel to myself and no one else is around and I kind of have the run of a place, you know, stuff like that does kind of appeal to me for a short time at least. So I do like these kind of post-apocalyptic stories and exploring these ideas. You mentioned Walking Dead, the famous image, I think, when they were promoting the TV show was Rick Grimes on horseback with all the abandoned cars, him going into Atlanta, I believe. Also, I see similarities in Brian K. Vaughan's writing to Robert Kirkman, who is the creator and writer of Walking Dead. So I do see similarities. They're both guys who really enjoy picking apart these ideas, these concepts, and really exploring what would happen. Like, Walking Dead is very much about, okay, so what would you do to rebuild society? And what would you do if you only had, you know, so much amount of food and you had to get this group of this size? And how would you decide who makes the decisions? So I do see similarities in their work. Have you read other stuff by Brian K. Vaughan?
I've read Ex Machina. Is that one of his books, I believe?
Oh, yes,
yeah,
it is.
Right. So Ex Machina, just because it was, I remember it was promoted on Wizard Magazine, a favorite magazine of both myself and Matt, I guess, from our youth. And they had an article about Ex Machina, and I remember reading that at the library and loving it. So, I definitely enjoy his writing. And of course, Lost. I mean, we've watched Lost, and Lost is also a pretty solid TV show.
Did you finish Lost? Did you make it to the end of the series?
I did, and I was disappointed with the ending. I thought that they had so many great chances, and they never really took a direction. I think it was just a mystery box, right? I mean, that J.J. Abrams, his whole idea was to have it be a mystery box. So you just kind of throw things like the smoke monster out or whatever it is, like the latch and a time travel, all this stuff. And then the characters would have to deal with that situation. But by the end of the series, I felt like it lost direction. because
we'll be here all night, folks.
Yeah, exactly. So because of that mystery box, it kind of couldn't figure out what it wanted to do, you know, as a series. And so I just didn't like the ending at all.
I had a hard time with that last season. Lost, I'm one of the few people I know, so you and I are, I'm in very much the minority of my close circle of people who actually finished that series. A lot of people abandoned and gave up on it much earlier than the final season. I think they did some interesting things. I don't know if I was totally satisfied with the final conclusion. I thought the second to last season was really a return to form, and I really enjoyed the second to last season when they were having kind of the sideways narratives of, or the parallel narratives of some of the people escaping to the mainland and living life back in society, and some people still stuck on the island back in the past. But again, going back to these kind of narratives, or these parallels, sorry, Lost, like, I kind of got into it around the second season, I think, and I kind of binged the first two seasons, and it was awesome. And then really, as soon as I caught up and was watching it kind of on a week-to-week basis, and also, like, the third season is also kind of derided anyway, but just it happened to be the time I caught up on Lost and just kind of waiting between episodes, it did kind of lose me a little bit. And I don't know if it's because I was binging and you set up all these mysteries, but then you got another episode to keep going. And it was one of those episodes that's really hard to watch at night because it always ends on like a cliffhanger. You're like, what? And I ended up having to like watch like 10 minutes of the next episode just so I wouldn't go to sleep on this massive cliffhanger between episodes. And similar to how I was reading Why the Last Man, it was introduced to me by my good friend, Jocelyn Nazim, who went to the same high school as me in Malaysia, and we were working together at summer school, and he gave me the first three volumes, and I read those all back to back, and they're awesome. And then around the fourth volume of Why the Last Man, it didn't have that same sort of propulsion that I see in these first three volumes, like the first 15 issues or so. And then I was waiting longer and longer between volumes. So I waited for trade paperback. So I was waiting like 6 months until I was getting my next fix of Why the Last Man. And it did kind of drag on and kind of lose me a little bit. But I really do feel like they kind of recovered. And I do, again, not going to spoil anything for the ending, but I think that this series ends really strong. But it's just weird that it is kind of similar to Lost, given the fact that Brian K. Vaughan worked on Lost as well. But you also brought up mystery boxes. So, I mean, if for anyone who hasn't seen one of the many J.J. Abrams videos online, can you explain, kind of summarize J.J. Abrams' mystery box writing approach?
I can probably roughly kind of go over it. But yeah, a mystery box is just a cluster of concepts that can be just deployed to add more tension to your story. So let's say, you know, on Lost, these survivors are on an island. Okay, that's your first concept. But then you have this mystery box full of things like the smoke monster, time travel, the underground bunker, you know, other characters. You know, you have all these concepts that are kind of sitting there. So you just throw these concepts at the established storyline of the people sitting on the island, and then you see how they react, or you know how the story kind of propels them to change. So in this case, and also it doesn't quite explain everything either. So the things like the smoke monster, for several seasons, no one knew what exactly it was. That they only knew that it existed. And it creates a sense of wonder too in the viewer, because you're like, oh, what is that, right? Like, how does that happen? And you're asking all these questions, and you're talking to your friends about it. It's like that smoke monster. It's like it must be not just a smoke monster. There must be some kind of physical entity within it or something, you know. And you can, it creates all this intrigue So
that's intrigue, but he yeah. never has the answers. And
yeah,
he,
exactly.
And his big theory is that the mystery is what's compelling. That's what brings people back in, not the answers. And the answers are kind of not important to him.
But people need answers. People need some kind of structure.
So you want to have answers. So because you did mention that these five issues kind of set up different possible explanations for what caused the plague to wipe out everyone and every creature with a Y chromosome. There's the Amulet of Helene. The Dr. Man gives birth to a clone. Yorick thinks that he survived because he's got this magic ring from a magic shop that he bought, and he was planning to use that as an engagement ring. There's a few other things that some people think that Arab terrorists are to blame. So there's a few possible explanations given out. But so there are possible explanations. We don't obviously get any answers in this one. So he is setting up these sort of mystery boxes. But I think the difference here is Brian K. Vaughan does have answers, and everything that he sets up here, it's not just like in Lost where random things are set up, like there's a polar bear on the island, whoa, and that makes everyone question, and like you said, talk about with your friends, what does the polar bear mean? But the creators of Lost, they weren't quite sure what the polar bear meant yet, and they always just kind of said, we'll get to it when we get to it. But here, with Why the Last Man, and with his other books, like Ex Machina, he knows where it's going, and everything is set up, like, again, like Jurassic Park. Everything in these first volumes pays off later. Every little character we see, pretty much, if we spend any kind of time with, every line, it all pays off at some point. It all comes back and means something in the end. So that is the difference. The question of what causes the plague, I think that kind of is a bit of a mystery box. I don't think that matters as much as some of the other things that he sets up. Again, reminds me, going back to zombies, I'm a big fan of George Romero's zombies, Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, one of my favorite movies, Day of the Dead. But he very famously kind of said, like, it doesn't matter what caused the zombie plague. And in Walking Dead, you never really find out what it is that caused the zombies to come to life and to, you know, attack and eat the living. And it also reminds me of Twin Peaks. I don't know if you're a big fan of Twin Peaks, but the whole idea of Twin Peaks is they set up this mystery of who killed Laura Palmer, and they never really wanted to explain it. They very purposely weren't going to give us a solution to an answer to that question of who killed Laura Palmer, because they were hoping that we'd be invested in other mysteries and other storylines and the characters more than this central mystery. But they had pressure from the network to reveal how she died and who actually killed her. And then as soon as they revealed who killed Laura Palmer, the show took a huge dive and lost a bunch of ratings. So it is a weird balancing act of, like, how long can you keep this sort of juggling act of keeping the mysteries going? But I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you remember the rest of the series very well. I can't remember how long it's been since you've read this, but without giving anything away, like, do you really need to know what caused the plague while you're reading this first volume and beyond?
I think that is a mystery that is a bit of a guiding light for me when I was reading this book. And it's just, I think with every series or TV show that I watch, also with a ongoing mystery, it's a bit of a guiding light. You're just following that main thread while learning other things on the way, right? Like, so that I think there has to be some kind of payoff at the end. Just from a reader's perspective, I enjoy finding it out, and then you're like, oh my God, I can't believe that was it. Oh my, you know, like, I love that feeling, but it should be the end. It shouldn't be like in the middle of the series or something. Then it just loses everything, right? So as you mentioned with Twin Peaks, I never watched Twin Peaks, but same type of thing. Is it same concept, like, right? Like it. And also with Lost, I remember when they started unraveling things and showing the explanation for things like the smoke monster and stuff. And then you're like, oh, okay. Then you kind of lose a bit of steam in the mystery of it. But you need some kind of guiding light to kind of propel you to go through the story and to see the story through the character's point of view.
I disagree. For this one in particular, I feel like sometimes, you know, if you're going to tease it out so long, we need some kind of satisfying conclusion. But with this book, Why the Last Men, I don't think I care as much because for me, my favorite part of this book is the character, York. I love York Brown as a character. He's probably one of my favorite fictional characters, one of my favorite comic book characters. I relate to him quite a bit. I think that he's wonderfully flawed, but a little bit self-aware in his flaws, and he's just trying so hard to do the right thing, but he's still a bit young and has a lot to learn and makes mistakes and causes problems for himself and his companions. He's a big nerd. He's a big, you know, comic book movie fan, so he likes a lot of the same things that I like. There's a lot of references. He references Indiana Jones. He references Speed Racer, which I'm not a huge fan of, but I've made notes of the things that he references, and he speaks like you and I speak, I think, Gale, just dropping in lines from movies and making references to our favorite comic books and TV shows. So for me, what kept me going and kept me coming back and kept me sticking with this series was not so much this central mystery, but York as a character. I just really, really dig York. I'm a big fan of just, I like spending time with him. What's your opinion on York as the main character, the titular last man?
He is a pretty interesting character because, yeah, as you mentioned, he is very similar to the reader, I would say. You know, maybe Brian K. Vaughan did it on purpose to kind of speak to the audience that would be reading his comic book. And yeah, people like you and I, or people who are fans of the comic genre in general, would, you know, identify with York, and they would want him to survive, and they would want him to do well, and to also maybe, you know, just also maybe like have romantic entanglements on his journey. Those types of things, I think, are, yeah, just kind of, yeah, just aimed towards the reader, I would say, than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely saw a lot of myself in him when he's kind of working up the courage and the nerve to propose to his girlfriend Beth on the phone. He says there's no other, he didn't think there were any other girls like him, or he didn't think there were girls like him, someone who likes Miller's Crossing. So he, one of the big attractions for him is that she's into the same stuff as him. And I think you and I can both speak to this, you know, when we were younger, maybe his age, I think he's like 25-ish when the series starts. He's been out of college for a couple years, but that obviously was a big fantasy of mine as a younger man. Like, oh man, it'd be so great to find a beautiful woman who's also into comics and into the same movies as me, and I could share all these interests. And I ended up with someone who is perfect for me, and my wife Emma is amazing, but she doesn't care about comics or, you know, movies in quite the same way as me. She will enjoy them with me, and she appreciates that I like them, but I, as I mentioned, like, you know, he's got a bit of learning to do. And just because someone is into the same things as you, it doesn't necessarily make them the perfect romantic life partner. I don't know. I mean, can you relate to that sort of realization, Cale?
Very much so, actually. I remember
we are so lucky to have the women we have, but sorry.
Yeah, they don't, exactly.
They don't listen to this show. They don't. Yeah.
They put up with a lot. But yeah, I remember at one point I was dating a girl that was who had similar interests as mine, like as far as like comic books and filmmaking and things like that. But yeah, it just didn't work out because there were other parts that I also enjoy, as in, like, you know, financial planning and
you're one of those financial planning nerds.
Stability, you know, like those are things you need when you want to kind of build a long lasting relationship. And yeah, I'm just digging myself into a hole right now. So I'm just going
to I'm just trying to point out there's more to a romantic partnership than being into comics together and being into to movies. And I do have to say, not that either of them will ever listen to this, but the fact that we do have wives who are willing to dress up in cosplay and go with us to comic conventions, even though they don't give a crap, that is amazing. We're both very lucky, lucky men, Cale.
That's true.
Very lucky. Shout out to our wives. Hi, honey, if you're listening to this after I've died and you're enacting the protocol of listening to my voice for hours and hours. I love you. Anyways, moving on. I want to talk about the other characters. So York and Ampersand are kind of at the heart of this. Early on, we meet Agent 355, who works for the Culper Ring, this sort of super secret organization, and she becomes kind of his handler, bodyguard, guide. And then they eventually, at the end of this, the issue five, they finally team up with Dr. Mann, who is the leading expert on cloning, and they kind of form this sort of team. And that's, this is the team kind of going forward for the rest of the series. So starting with Agent 355, what's your take on her, Kale?
She is amazing. She is so self-actualized. She's, I think, the best kind of like, yeah, just multi-talented woman in this on the in the series. I thought of, I don't know if you ever watched the Venture Brothers, the TV show.
Of course, man.
Yeah, so I was thinking of Brock, you know, from the Venture Brothers, who's just completely yes. capable of anything and just like is a killing machine and is just like so skilled that, you know, he doesn't really need anything, anything or anyone. And yeah, I was thinking of Brock Sampson as, you know, the, I guess, the male version of Agent 355.
Yeah, and she's very capable. She kicks ass. Like, I mean, New York would have been dead by issue three if it wasn't for her. I mean, she definitely keeps the team, you know, going forward and keeps everything kind of on track. She does play it a little close to the chest, and maybe it's because I just relate to York so much that I can fill in a lot of the gaps. But I feel like, and but also I think it is just his character that York is just so much more out there and just has no filter and kind of just shares every thought that pops into his head. But 355, because she's a secret agent, you know, and she does have a big secret that is revealed later on in the series, but she does really kind of, she's a very closed off, guarded character. And we do see glimpses into everyone's backstory, and there's reasons for that. You know, she, not to spoil too much, but she was orphaned at a young age. They make a passing reference to that in this volume anyway. But we see a bit more of that detail. So she is a very closed off character. So she's a little bit more impenetrable. And that does, I think, add to the bit of that kind of badass mystique. Dr. Mann, the kind of third human companion, what's your take on her? Because I always found her as a real kind of killjoy.
Yeah, she is a bit stiff, I would say, as a character. And I actually, I think I only read volume one, so originally, and rereading it for the show, I always felt like, yeah, she was kind of a stiff character who maybe she becomes more open in volume two through five. Or
she doesn't really, and I haven't read it in a while, like I said, but like she never really warms up to York's crap.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I didn't like her as much as a character. And I was kind of interested in her plot with the cloning, though. I thought that was a pretty cool angle for her. But I don't even recall what happened. What, honestly, I mean, it's, I don't remember what happened after, you know, the first volume with her cloning.
Have you read the whole series?
I have not. No. So
so you never finished it.
I read volume one and volume two, but I don't remember what happened in volume two. And it was, you know, what, 12, 13 years ago that I read it. I don't know. I don't know what happens with the story. And now that I've read volume one, I think I'll just go back and, you know, go through the different volumes just because I'm just interested in the story now. So I'm invested.
It's worth sticking through, and anyone who's just read the first volume for this episode, I do recommend sticking through. I've read it as it was coming out in volumes, so every 6 months I would read another volume when it originally came out. The ending I do find satisfying, even though I said like I felt there's a bit of a dip kind of three quarters of the way through, but then I reread the whole thing. I think I reread the whole thing when I was on my honeymoon. We had 2 weeks. It was just like hanging out and hanging by the pool during the days, and I was just reading comics, and we were, you know, just going to the buffet and going to the beach and going to the pool. It was lovely, but I was reading a lot of comics, and I think I reread Why the Last Man from start to finish, and it does work really well when you kind of read the whole thing in one go. So it does play really well, and it does, I think, stick the landing. So I do recommend going through and finishing it, Kale. Like, it'd be interesting to do a follow-up episode at some point and see what you thought. But absolutely. Yeah, she never, Dr. Mann never really, and it, I understand you want dynamics, you want, you know, conflict between the characters, but when you've got a character that I personally just love so much, and then you just got this kind of wet blanket who never laughs at anything he does and can't understand him. And I guess that is realistic when you're a younger man like that, who just talks in comic book and movie quotes. It can get really annoying and frustrating for people around them. You and I think can both relate to that, but, and they're kind of forced to be together, but like, it's just kind of a bummer that there's this third character who just doesn't ever really warm up to the main character, who is the reason that I'm buying these volumes and buying these issues and coming back to the story, like, because I like this one main character. And then you got this one character who's, one of her main things is like, she doesn't like the reason you were buying the book. It's kind of judgmental on you as the reader. I don't know.
Yeah, I can't quite understand her inclusion in this the book, but I guess I'll find out when I keep reading this series.
Well, like you said, like, it is interesting that she was nearly successful in creating a clone, and she is the brains of the operations. She has the scientific knowledge that is hopefully going to restart humanity and save the world. So they need her for her expertise. And she does have a bit of a warmer relationship with 355, but it is just a huge bummer. It'd be like Batman hanging out with someone who just didn't like Batman the whole time. Like, I don't want Batman to be on a team with someone who just doesn't realize how cool Batman is, you know. I don't know if that's a good metaphor, but like, if there's a character that's making me buy this book and come and read this story, and then there's another character who's a prominent character who's a big part of their personality is like, no, this guy is a jerk and this guy is a dumbass, I that just kind of bums me out when York is why I'm here. Speaking of, I said, like, York is really just kind of open and just has no filter, and I think really helps, you know, invite you into this world and in his mind. There was something that I made a note of with the writing. Did you notice this, Kale? There's no voiceover. There's no narration in the entire series.
Oh, yeah. And I guess if we were to get some kind of insight into what York is thinking, we have to interpret his dreams as kind of...
There are a lot of dreams as the series goes on. Yeah. But besides that, I mean, he is just kind of verbally espousing what he's thinking, but also kind of a cool trick that Brian K. Vaughan employs is he's got his helper monkey, Ampersand, with him the whole time. So he can speak to Ampersand. And I think he makes a note. He says something in one of these issues like, and I'm just talking to a monkey now, you know, I'm going crazy talking to a monkey. But because he's got this monkey who doesn't understand him, can't respond, but he can, you know, act out, and he can give us what would be voiceover narration, but he's saying it out loud to this monkey. So it does kind of fulfill that kind of function in the story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I like Ampersand as a sidekick, but I was also thinking of the Friends reference with when Ross got a monkey
and maybe Marcel.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe it is kind of influenced by Friends because it was around the same era as well. But yeah, I like his, you know, animal sidekick situation.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is an interesting setup, you know, it gives him someone to talk to, but also it does create a larger mystery. When Dr. Mann sees York, she's kind of not that fazed by York, and she's more impressed that Ampersand is a male capuchin monkey. And she's like, yeah, obviously you're a human male, but the fact that also your monkey survived, that's really interesting. So what was it that saved both of you? But yeah, I always imagined, I don't know if that monkey is still alive. I'm not sure how long capuchins live, but that monkey from Friends, I'm pretty sure that was the same monkey who was the monkey in the original Outbreak film. I know that they make a joke of it in Friends, the series, that the monkey's filming Outbreak 2. But I always imagined if this series was ever turned into a TV show or movie, which they've been trying to do for years and years and years, they're finally doing it, but I always thought it'd probably be the same monkey. I thought it'd be kind of a cool, you know, I know that monkey sort of thing. But yeah, Ampersand's a cool character, you know, it's cute having a monkey. Monkeys in real life though, Kale, like, do you have much experience with real life monkeys?
Well, actually, I do. Shockingly, when I was growing up in Sri Lanka, we used to get monkeys all the time at our school, and they would steal everything from, you know, your lunch to first aid kit. My mom's school, my mom's classroom actually had a dead monkey in it because it got into the first aid box and then ate a bunch of aspirin pills, maybe aspirin or ibuprofen or something, and just OD'd. So it happens. It happens. And you tend to stay away from the monkeys as much as possible.
They're horrible in real life. So we had monkeys growing up in Malaysia as well. And if you left your window open, your door open, they would get in. The two things they loved to tear apart was toilet paper. So if they got into your bathroom, they would just rip apart the toilet paper. Or if they got into your kitchen, they would rip apart your bread and just be like chunks of bread everywhere. And they're nasty, dirty pests. Like, real wild monkeys are not cute. They're not funny. They're just really nasty, vicious things. And they can be quite aggressive. And there'd be certain areas where you would avoid walking down this part of the street because there'd be these low-hanging trees, and sometimes the monkeys would come down, and like the alpha male monkey would be there, and he was like just this nasty, nasty beast. Speaking of dead monkeys too, when I was growing up, there was a monkey who got fried on electric wire, and so he was just kind of crisp monkey hanging. It was really sad. And then the really sad part is that whoever was in charge of taking care of this dead monkey, they left the hands hanging. So they chopped the body off, and we went back a couple of days later, and there's just these fried hands hanging on to the electric wires.
Oh.
Yeah. But yeah, real life monkeys, not cute, not fun, not good companions. And I mean, Ampersand in this story is kind of a terribly trained monkey. He is really, he escapes. He does not do anything that he's supposed to do with Yorick. Very, very poorly trained monkey.
Like in the book, he escapes the White House, and like Yorick has to go look for him and stuff. Do you think that Ampersand is more of a MacGuffin? Like, he's just there to kind of add a sense of chaos to the book?
He does factor in heavily to some of the answers and some of the mysteries, and so he does play a larger role, and I do think that it is notable that Dr. Mann says, you know, the fact that both of you survived, that is important. So he does play a function as a MacGuffin, sort of, you know, he is maybe an answer to some of these mystery boxes, and they do have to kind of, he gets into trouble and they have to go and rescue him and gets them into trouble. So he does serve a lot of plot function, but he does also play a larger role in the narrative, and he does factor into some of the solutions to some of the problems. So Ampersand is not just a cute monkey. Like there is a, just like everything in this book, there is a purpose to him. But really quick, I just want to go back to that narration point I want to make. It's just, it gives the book a different feel. Comics very often have voiceover narration, but by eliminating that, we're left to interpret the characters' thoughts and their emotions and their impressions on things from their dialogue, but also from their facial expressions and also their actions. But also it lets the creative team show us much more in their flashbacks rather than just kind of explaining things in narration. So it feels somewhat more cinematic, but also very much is showing more than telling. So I like that. And he employs the same sort of technique, the same sort of style in Ex Machina, his book with Tony Harris, where there is no voiceover, there's no narration, there's no inner monologue. You see everything kind of play out, and it definitely makes his book stand out from other books. He doesn't do it with Saga. Saga very famously does have narration from the main character as an adult looking back and narrating the whole story. But it's just kind of a cool little thing that one change really does create quite a different reading experience. One thing I want to say about the lettering, another thing about the lettering before we kind of move on to maybe the art a little bit. On the very first page of the first issue, something that I really kind of dig is this overlapping speech balloons. So characters talking over one another. So we literally see one character's balloon, but it, like, the last line, the last sentence, and part of the words in that sentence are covered up by someone else's balloon interrupting and speaking over them. It's kind of a cool thing. It really helps me hear the interplay and the dialogue, a very kind of a naturalistic way of writing characters' dialogue. Anything else you want to say about the writing? I've got just so many notes here about how everything does pay off, and, you know, and there's just also so much about gender in language, which I thought was interesting. Like, just, it really kind of makes you think about how much of our English language is gendered when the characters are using different idioms and phrases that are either male or female. And it just really makes you think about, you know, how much gender is part of the way we talk.
Yeah. I was also thinking about, how Yorick talks to other women when he's wearing his mask. And if he is using like a high voice or something, like how do the women not just recognize that it's a man who's talking to them? Possibly because of, you know, that every man has died and maybe they're like, oh, it's just a deep voiced woman. But yeah, I just wonder what his voice sounds like normally. And the other thing I was wondering, or not wondering, but the other thing I observed was that when he meets Rose at the Washington Monument and they are having a conversation, you could see the word bubbles, go left to right as the conversation evolves. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really cool from a perspective coming from like a cartoonist. You know, I remember I was when I was doing my webcomic and stuff, I used to struggle with word bubbles all the time, just because I didn't know how to, you know, fit in enough words or dialogue into word bubbles, and, you know, how to even move it around to make sure that people read it from left to right. So yeah, I thought that was some cool
work. Yeah, those balloons, when they're having the discussion about just how many bands are completely gone now, and that's another thing that Brian K. Vaughan's thinking about, like just how much, what celebrities and what creative people, like all these bands that are completely male are just gone now. So they're just naming bands back and forth. And the placement of the speech balloons is just really easy to read because it does kind of follow this zigzag pattern, top to bottom, left to right. The same way that we read the panels, we start in the top left and we move across the page left to right, then we go down to the next row and move across, and that's the way that these balloons are placed. I really like that, this kind of back and forth dialogue. It's another really cool use of speech balloons in comics. It makes it very easy to read when you're just kind of following that zigzag ping-ponging back and forth. The other thing that you said, the voice for Yorick, I believe they make reference to the fact that he's putting on a voice, and he references how he was on stage and played female characters on stage. His dad is a big English professor, and Yorick and his sister Hero, who shows up a little bit in this book but becomes more important later on, they're both named after obscure Shakespearean characters. Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well. And Hero, I'm not sure, I was going to look it up, what play Hero is from. So Shakespeare, in the time of Shakespeare, when Shakespeare's company was putting on all these plays, females weren't allowed on stage, so all the female parts were played by male actors. So again, just thinking about how gender has been such a, you know, a big thing in the past and even now in the present, relating it back to Shakespeare, making you think about the fact that in Shakespeare's time, all of the female characters were played by male actors. Kind of what Yorick is doing now. He's kind of embodying that sort of Shakespearean acting role. And I do think as the series continues, they do make reference to his voice slipping. And, you know, he does a pretty terrible job of keeping his identity secret. Like in issue 3, I believe it is, outside the monument, he rips off his mask and confronts some of the Amazons, who become, again, more important later as the series goes on, as kind of secondary, if not primary, villains at certain points. But he does just keep putting himself in danger and putting his companions in danger by revealing the fact that he is a surviving male. And it does bring up, and again, it's a bit of a throwaway line, but it becomes more important later, that he's got this kind of survivor's guilt and he kind of has a death wish, and he is putting himself in these needlessly dangerous situations that he doesn't need to go out and pick these fights that he picks. But the voice is a runner that he doesn't always keep the act up very well as the story goes on.
Yeah, he is pretty reckless with his identity. And I find that it was just, well, I find it kind of funny as a character flaw, I suppose. that he's just like, I'm a male, I can do whatever the hell I want. I want to, you know, like he seems a bit chauvinistic at first, quite honestly.
He's very headstrong and has to learn. That's one of the lessons he has to learn for sure.
Exactly. So, maybe that's also something that Brian K. Vaughan wanted to highlight about the difference between men and women. He's just kind of almost to a fault, like in a very dumb way, is trying to show everyone that he's alive, you know. So it seems kind of counterproductive to his overall mission, I guess.
Yeah, it's he definitely has an arc, and I do hope that you finish reading it. I think I'm gonna go back and, like I said, continue reading this, because he does go through a lot of changes, and the series takes place over a couple years, and it kind of evolves in real time almost. But he does go through a change, and he does have a character arc. He does definitely mature and grow up, because the series takes place over several years. So he does go through changes, and he does learn to kind of curb some of his, you know, his less desirable qualities, and he does grow up quite a bit as the series goes on. We're running low on time, but let's talk about the art, because Pia Guerra's art is just, it's awesome, Kale. I really quick want to tell a story about how I met her at VanCAF, the Vancouver Comics Art Festival. I knew she was going to be there, and Emma and I were rushing to get organized, because VanCAF, every time I've done the VanCAF convention, I'm always on the waiting list, and I don't really get the thumbs up, the okay, until like a couple days before, so it's always a last minute scramble to actually get prepared to go to this big convention. But packing the car, I knew that I had to bring all my volumes of Why the Last Man, because I knew that Pia Guerra was going to be there. I wanted her to sign them. And I also, anytime I meet someone who makes stuff that I really like, I like to give them a copy of my books and just kind of say, hey, I really enjoy what you create, maybe you'll like what I create. So I was like, hey, I'm really sorry, can you sign like these 9 volumes for me? She's like, yeah, no problem, of course. And then I was like, also, you know, here's one of my books, you might enjoy it. And I gave her a copy of There's Plenty of Emmas in the World, a collection of my Smith vs. Smith webcomics. And her husband, Ian Boothby, who is a writer for The Simpsons, he was tabling next to her, and he leans over and looks at my book and says, actually, we already have that book. And I was like, oh, cool, trying to play it cool. But I was just like, my mind was blown. And they're like, yeah, we saw it at Golden Age Collectibles in Vancouver yesterday, and we bought it because our daughter's named Emma. And I was like, cool. You know what? Hey, I'll be right back. I might have another book then. So like, I walked away until I was like out of their view line or their eye line. And I just ran back to my table and was like, Emma, give me another book really quick. Something really cool happened, I'll tell you in a second. And I grabbed a copy of my Three Crushes book and I ran back and then walked over and like, yeah, cool, whatever. Here's another book you might like as well of mine. No big deal. But the fact that Pia Guerra and her husband Ian Boothby saw my book on a shelf in a comic book store at Golden Age Collectibles and picked it up just was awesome. One of my festival convention highlights.
Yeah, that's amazing. I guess she was visiting from somewhere, because I remember going to Golden Age Collectibles with you that time. Yeah. And trying to sell them some books and stuff. And Golden Age Collectibles is one of, I think, the, or maybe the biggest comic book store in Vancouver. And it's where celebrities, writers, or, you know, like people who make films in Vancouver, they go there. So it's like the main kind of store to go to. And it's kind of nice that your book was, you know, featured there. And I went back maybe a few months later and your book was gone. So,
okay, because you never know.
There you go. So people were buying it. So that's you getting a slot on their shelf was just such a huge thing for me.
It was pretty cool for me as an indie creator. I think that was the first time a comic book store, and to be fair, they're really great at supporting indie creators. It wasn't a lot of like negotiation. It was just like, hey, you know, would you guys be interested in putting this on your shelf? And they're like, yeah, of course, man. You know, how much you sell it for? This is how much we would pay you for it, and this is how much we would keep. And again, like, just trying to play it cool. Like, okay, cool, no big deal. But then I got a picture, and it pops up every couple of years on my Facebook memories of my Smith versus Smith, my original book, the first time you and I went to drop books off there, displayed cover facing out next to and on top of and below Spider-Man books and Superman books, because it was in the S section. And it's just a really cool thing. And like, it's such a simple, small thing for a comic book store. And they're, like you said, the biggest comic book store in Vancouver, right on Granville Street. It's a great store. They're not going to make, you know, huge money off of me giving them a couple copies of my books. You know, it doesn't really help them, but it's just a small act of support and a small act of kindness on the part of a comic book store to display an indie comic book. It just makes a huge difference and is just such a cool thing for us indie creators. Yeah, it was cool. And it was cool that you were there for me the first time I went to drop books off.
Yeah, that was a great experience. I guess I was just so impressed that they put you with like the Batman books and the Green Lantern books and stuff like that. So
yeah, with the real stuff. It was
Yeah.
Every time it pops up on Facebook, that one image of just my book surrounded by these legit big comics, it's cool, man. It's a little things like that just help you keep plugging away at making your own comics. Yeah. But Pia Guerra's art, I love it, man. What I really like about it, and I'm really curious to see what you think about this, it's just such good, strong, fundamental storytelling. There's no crazy panel layouts. It's very much just sort of very rectilinear, no fuss, no muss, very straightforward storytelling. There's, I think, only like once or twice she really does anything that crazy with, and it's not even that crazy. Like she's got the, when they reveal the Washington Monument, we have this kind of bleed page that goes all the way to the edge of the arc, and there's two panels, inset panels kind of floating on top. Everything else, there's just this clean white gutter between all the panels. There's no panels overlapping, really. There's no panels crashing into each other. It's just very easy and straightforward to read. As someone who always talks about how you love crazy 90s comics with, you know, crazy layouts and crazy art, how do you feel about Pia Guerra's very meat and potatoes approach to comic book illustration?
I love her art, too, and I was thinking while I was reading the first volume is that she draws these women in more of a realistic fashion, not like any, let's say, mm-hmm. if like a male artist would draw females, right? Like in a kind of a hypersexual kind of way. But I think that it's just so realistic, and it's the best kind of art you would want for a book about, you know, women being, I guess, the main dominant kind of gender on Earth.
It is, yeah. It's not written with a male gaze. That I'm trying not to stereotype or generalize or be disparaging, but a lot of comics are written or illustrated, I think, from a male gaze and with a male audience in mind. I think a lot of what you would expect, you know, from like mainstream superhero comics, you know, and there's a lot of things you can find online just pointing out just how hypersexualized female characters are in superhero comics. I don't know if you have you heard of Project Hawkeye on the internet, Kale?
I have not, no.
It was a couple years ago where artists were just recreating images of mostly from like comic book covers of female superhero characters in these very provocative poses, but replacing the characters, redrawing them with Hawkeye from the Avengers, just to really highlight just how hypersexualized these female characters are and just how weird it would look if it was a male character in the same position. So like one of the most famous ones that I remember is like Spider-Woman, and she's crawling on a wall, but she's got like her butt sticking out and like her breasts are showing as well. And she's just contorted in this way that shows off as much of her body as possible. And then the Project Hawkeye went and replaced it and redrew it with Hawkeye kind of crawling, and he's got his butt sticking out and he's got his chest pushed out. And it just really shows just how insane it is that how much this male gaze is used in most comic book illustration. And it is just really refreshing to not have that in this series illustrated by Pia Guerra. And it's also, I think, really important that the co-creators, it's a male and female team. I think that probably really has a lot to do with the success of this book and the kind of approach to these characters and approach to this world.
What do you think of the coloring and the inking of this book?
Yeah, inking by Jose Marzan Jr., I really like. It's also, I think that Jose brings a lot to the story because, as I kind of alluded to, there's certain issues down the road where Pia Guerra, I think, needed time to catch up, and putting out a monthly comic of 20-something issues or 20-something pages every issue, like it takes a lot out of you. But I believe Jose Marzan Jr. stays on as the inker, even when they bring in guest pencilers, and it really helps to kind of maintain consistency in the final art. So it does kind of look like Pia Guerra was there. I know coming up in one of the future issues, one of my friends, Paul Chadwick, creator of Concrete, comes in as a guest artist for two issues. And it really feels like he tried to ape some of the camera angles and the perspectives that Pia Guerra has chosen. So I think she establishes this strong sort of visual style that Jose inks over and really kind of cements. I think it's very, really nicely illustrated. The coloring, I think, is really nice. It's kind of a very muted palette, which really helps with this kind of very down-to-earth, realistic story. The original volumes, again, like most of these books that we've been reading, Kale, I've got them on Comixology, so I'm reading them on my iPad or on my phone while I'm feeding the baby and calming the baby and got a sleeping baby on me. But in Canada, again, I've got the actual volumes, and it's this is from Vertigo, an imprint of DC Comics. They're kind of their HBO adult storytelling imprint. But the paper is, it's not like shiny, glossy paper for most of their books. It's a bit more newsprinty, and this kind of coloring, this kind of muted color palette works really well when printed on this kind of paper. So it's just gorgeous. Yeah, what do you think of the inking and the coloring, Kale?
I really like the inking because it actually reminded me of like the 90s kind of look a little bit more than the newer comics, I would say. I think newer comics, there's something missing in like heavy inks. I love heavy inks, and I just like that style. As far as the coloring is concerned, again, maybe I'm looking at it from more of a modern lens, but I wish the coloring was a little bit more dynamic. There's a scene where Agent 355 has fallen from the train. This is actually in Volume 2, I believe, not in Volume 1. I was just looking at it because I was flipping through the book. It looked like, you know, she was bleeding from her head, but the blood wasn't red. It was more brown. So maybe it's my digital copy that I have, and maybe that's what it is. But it just, in certain scenes, the blood is like bright red, like almost like unrealistic red, because blood is a little bit, you know, it's a darker red, right? So there's that. And then there's, you know, the scene where Agent 355 is bleeding from the head, and it's kind of brown. So I'm not sure what happened.
I like the flatness. I like it. Again, it goes back to this kind of bare bones. No, it's not flashy because it's straightforward storytelling. So I like that it is a bit of flatter color. On our episode of Batman Mad Love with Ryan Howe, we talked about the coloring on Batman Mad Love, the digital coloring. And it was one of the first books, or one of the earlier books, to use digital coloring. And it just really feels like they were trying every trick in the toolkit, every Photoshop trick. And it was like over airbrushed and just too much digital coloring. I like that this is just a bit of a softer touch. And full credit to everyone who worked on this team. So Clem Robbins was the letterer. Really cool lettering stuff we pointed out with the overlapping balloons and the back and forth dialogue. Pam Rambo is the colorist, at least on these issues that we've read. And cover art by J.G. Jones. Really cool covers as the series goes on. In Pam Rambo's defense as the colorist, you're talking about the fantasy scenes has really vibrant red, bold red for Beth's, you know, vision bleeding. But then in the kind of the real world, it's a bit duller and more rusty. And I believe when blood is exposed to oxygen, it's not as vibrant red as you would see in, you know, the movies. It is a bit more kind of rusty brown. So I'm going to say that was a conscious choice to be realistic. That's my take on it. Before we wrap up, I just want to say that this ends on a really cool image of York and Dr. Mann and 355 and Ampersand standing on a crossroads, literally standing on a crossroads, trying to decide where to go. But it's this overhead shot of them on a street in Boston, and the road forms into a Y shape. And there's just all these Ys all over the book in the series, but also very much in the covers by J.G. Jones. There's always some kind of Y shape, whether it's the way York is standing or the background, or looking at issue two, him and the supermodel turned dump truck driving body collector. the way the two characters are positioned, they're creating this sort of Y shape. So it's kind of like in the X-Men movies where you can find hidden X's everywhere. In this book, you can find hidden Y's kind of all over the place.
Yeah, that's cool. I noticed that as well. And I really appreciate these covers too, because the covers are like well painted, you know, and a little bit different from the digital art that you see on comic book covers normally. So I really appreciate the awesome art on the covers.
Yeah, it's very much a Vertigo thing to have really, you know, artistic covers by a different artist. So J.G. Jones has these fully painted covers that doesn't look exactly like Pia Guerra's and Jose Marzan Jr.'s interior art, but that is kind of just a Vertigo thing. That's what the publisher does usually. Like even the Preacher covers and the Sandman covers, created by someone who is a bit more of a classical artist, fully painted here. That, you know, they're very striking. They're very arresting. Really, really cool covers. We'll share some of the covers on our social media. Kale, where can people find us online on social media?
You can find us at Matt and Kale Read Comics on Facebook and Instagram, or at Matt and Kale Read on Twitter.
And Kale, you wanted to throw some plugs out there for your video series on YouTube. Tell us about that, because you've got another comic related YouTube video out.
That's right. So I recently did a video on Chadwick Boseman and his speech at Howard University. I also referenced Marvel's What If series because that's what actually brought up Chadwick Boseman for me recently anyway, because he voiced T'Challa in that series. And it just hearing his voice was such a great feeling for me, because it was, you know, like hearing an old friend speak yet again. It was an awesome episode as well. So I was just compelled to do a video on him. So feel free to watch it on YouTube at Life Coach Kale. That's my channel name. Or search for Life Coach Reacts to Chadwick Boseman's Speech.
And we will share that on our social media as well. I know that Chadwick Boseman is, you're a big fan of his work and his character, especially his work as Black Panther, but also as him as a person, Kale. So it's kind of cool that because of animation, he's able to give one last performance as that character, and also just in general, another performance from him.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to let people know, if you are in the UK, I will be a guest at the Lakes International Comic Arts Festival in Kendal, in England. That's taking place the weekend of October the 15th. That's Friday, October the 15th through Sunday, October 17th, Lakes International Comics Art Festival. I'll be tabling there, but also I'm running a workshop on drawing time in comics. And I'm also participating in a event where myself and some other autobiographical cartoonists are talking about how drawing our own lives has changed our lives. So if you are in the UK and you're excited as I am to go back to conventions, Lakes International Comics Art Festival, LICAF, is in October, and I will be there as a guest. Very excited to get back to conventions for the first time in about 2 years. We will be back in 2 weeks for another episode. September is when Batman Day is. We're huge fans of Batman, so of course we are going to be doing a Batman book for the month in which Batman Day falls. Kale, we are reading Gotham by Gaslight. It's a sort of what-if story of Batman. It takes place in DC's Elseworlds, where Batman is in kind of turn-of-the-century Gotham fighting Jack the Ripper, 19th century version of Bruce Wayne. It's written by Brian Augustin, with art by Mike Mignola, with inks by P. Craig Russell. Mike Mignola, who illustrated Dracula, which was the subject of our second episode. So we'll be back in 2 weeks for Gotham by Gaslight. I've got to go, Kale. I have to go take care of my baby while my wife goes out for the evening. This has been amazing. Thank you so much, Kale. Have a wonderful day. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for joining us, everyone.